This is Hometown Heroes, celebrating everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and our conversation today with an amazing 100-year-old who spent more than a quarter of those years in our armed forces, retiring from the Air Force as a colonel in 1969. George Eldridge lives in Nampa, Idaho now, but 73 years ago he was heading overseas to serve as a B-26 Marauder Bombardier with the 344th Bomb Group.
I went overseas on Saturnia, which was a Italian luxury liner, in January 44.
So you end up in England, and how soon were you flying missions?
Probably 3 days after I arrived, because the pilots and the navigator had flown the airplanes over, and I went over on the Saturnia, so I was a little late getting there.
So they were ready and waiting for you to fly your first mission as a bombardier in a B-26. What do you remember about that first mission?
It was only about an hour and 40 minutes, no flight. No excitement, climb out to 12 or 13,000 feet in formation, headed across the channel. And the first one, I didn't see any flak, but it wasn't long till I'd seen flak. And that's just a greasy fireball. It's red at first, but it's a greasy black ball in the air, and all kinds of little things falling off of it.
Yeah, you said it wasn't long till you saw flak. I know it also wasn't too long till you felt flak in your face, and we're going to hear that story. But some people, if they haven't learned much about this, they might say, well, if there's a puff of greasy smoke out there, just fly around it. That's not an option, is it?
No, it's so close, you're not going to fly around it.
And plus, you guys are flying in formation, right? So you have to keep formation. And maybe you should explain for folks, too, with the layout of that B-26, where you would be positioned as the bombardier and what your duties were.
I'm right in the nose. My navigator, because we were always a lead crew, I had a navigator as well as a bombardier. But there were two of us in there, and he was over 6 foot tall. And you can imagine how small that was.
So you guys were rubbing elbows literally in there?
Oh, yes. We were very close.
And you mentioned being a lead crew. That's a lot of responsibility. So that whole formation or the whole squadron, they're following your lead?
They drop when we drop, too. The pilots had to fly so the other pilots could stay with them, then we had to find and hit the target.
And how'd you do that? What kind of equipment did you have to locate the target?
Two eyes. We flew entirely by pilotage. Once we found what's called the initial point, and then you have another point so that you have time to align the formation and all that before you make your final turn on the target, because you don't like to have the flak tracking you for a long period of time. So you make turns. That upsets the flak gunners. If we did it properly, we could have a 30-second bomb run. The last 30 seconds, we'd open the bomb bay doors.
What kind of altitude were you typically dropping those bombs from?
Between 12 and 15,000.
What's the atmosphere or temperature or conditions of your cabin of that B-26 at that altitude?
It's not pressurized. You're at the mercy of the weather.
Brr. How cold did it get, you think?
It might be 10 below.
Do you have a heated suit or anything, or just some wool to keep your neck warm?
We usually wore long underwear. That'll do more than anything else to keep you warm.
How many missions did you end up completing with that squadron?
46 or something like that.
That's a lot of missions. I'm sure that there's more than one close call along the course of those 46 missions. Are there some that stand out for you, moments where came pretty close to claiming your life, or you weren't sure, or you saw the plane next to you go down? Are there some of those memories that still stick with you?
One of the one I remember the most was the most fouled up. It was after we had moved to Belgium, and the ground forces now were well into Germany. We were way up into Belgium where the Germans had been. We took the airbase over from the Germans. We had taken off with 12 airplanes. We were up about 12,000 feet, dodging clouds, and called bomber control and told them where we were, and we were down to 6 airplanes is all we had. And somebody in bomber control had an open mic and said, pass the coffee. And someone else said, complete your mission is briefed. And we're fighting above 12,000 feet, no oxygen, cold, and only 6 airplanes by this time. We got a little break in the weather, and the target was the bridge on the same spot that the ground forces crossed on, we were to hit the approach on the north end of that bridge. So the ground forces would slow the Germans down. So the ground forces were there in about 100 miles there at the time and moving quite fast. So we went in, and we were above 19,000 with no oxygen, and we'd been up there for 2.5-3 hours. So we were not very smart.
You've got to be lightheaded and almost feel like you're going to pass out or something.
Well, it's not a good feeling. Anyhow, everything is, I've got the bomb site set up, opened the bomb bay doors so they could open their doors before time to drop bombs. In the confusion, we were actually in a G-model airplane, which was new to us, and especially new to my navigator. And I had opened the bomb bay doors, and he thought I had missed it. And he reached over and hit the switch, and the switch is up or down, open or closed. It was up for open, and he pushed it down, so I opened the bomb bay doors. The other airplanes opened theirs, and then my doors closed. And some of them, one or two of them, closed their doors and others didn't. And then my bomb bay doors opened real quick, and out the bombs come. So my navigator, he took credit for that. The result was, as we turned off the target, we scattered bombs halfway to the North Pole. The first bombs I dropped, four, I think, went on the bridge, and the rest went out toward Poland or somewhere like that.
Well, you and your pilot, Tom Johnson, both received the Distinguished Flying Cross for that mission. Half of the 12 planes, as you said, had turned back because that weather was just so bad. And your guy's response was to avoid the clouds by climbing to an even more dangerous altitude, 19,000 feet. Sure sounds like that DFC was more than deserved, and we still need to get eventually to the mission where you earn the Purple Heart, but I've got to hit the rewind button because there was a mission before the one you just described that I'm sure people would like to hear about.
June 6th of 44. Everybody knows about what was happening on the beaches that day, but you were up in the skies above those beaches or above Europe that day, and you were one of the first planes to bomb, as I understand. What happened on that June 6th D-Day mission?
You have to go back to a couple of days before. The pilot I flew with and a couple of his buddies had gone to London. The wing commander called in all the navigators and bombardiers. He briefed us on it and put us in pairs. You do this, so you have to do this. You stay together until this mission is over. But the pilots were still in London, so they were a little late to get to the briefing. But they did make it, and Colonel Vance called us in the day before. He paired us off. You two will stay together. You two, you two, you two, you two. If one goes to the bathroom, you both go. You will not tell anybody, not any other crew members. Any of the pilots ask you, because there were none of the pilots at that briefing. They were just navigators and bombardiers. You don't say a word. If you have to, just turn and walk away. So I want to be absolutely sure there are no discussions of this mission before we are assembled at the briefing room. That's the first time you will hear anybody other than myself talk about this mission.
And that's not typical, right? So you're getting the sense that this is secret, that they're worried about spies or somebody finding out what's going to happen.
That's right. The navigator and I knew what the timing was going to be. The rest of the crews didn't know until 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning. The orderly come around, woke everybody up. So we had to go to the briefing room, and we took off right afterwards. And it was raining just like cats and dogs. As we went down the runway, the airplane just seemed to surge as it went over each puddle of water. And of course, that was 3 o'clock in the morning, or 4 o'clock.
So what did you see as you flew over the English Channel toward France?
We were above an overcast. It was a severe, heavy rain. We joined up in, there was enough light, you could see the heavy rain here or there. June, the sun comes up rather early, so we could see, had a little light to dodge heavy clouds. I think we never got above 9,000 feet, and I think we bombed at about 7,000 or less.
And what was your target? Where did you guys drop those bombs?
On the beach. We were the first airplanes in. I was the second airplane in.
OK, Can you describe that scene for us? I mean, this is a historic day, the longest day, a day that there's probably been more written about or talked about than just about any other day in history. So you're one of the first planes in, as you said. What did you see down there?
Just the coast. There was nothing unusual about the coast. We'd seen the coast so many times and seen so many pictures of it. We knew exactly where the Germans were using the old French forts. The defense forts had been built soon after Napoleon, I guess.
So you're dropping bombs on these beaches and the cliffs where, in the hours ahead, those American forces are going to be storming ashore. But you're bombing before the troops got there? Is that what you're saying?
Before. We went in, I don't know how much, an hour or so before. We softened up parts of the beach anyhow. However, some of those troops didn't. The National Guard troops from Council Grove, Kansas, were in that original ground forces on that beach. They got slaughtered there. I went back 2 or 3 days later when the weather was a little better. We only had 12 or 15 of these bombs in our inventory, the 2,000-pounders. Now, a 2,000-pounder is about as long as from here to the wall over there.
6 or 8 feet long and 2 feet wide?
Yeah. And we carried two in each airplane, and we only had 6 airplanes. The rest of the crews carried 500-pounders, but the 2,000-pounders were in just 6 airplanes out of my squadron. The beach didn't have any problem after that. The ground forces didn't have any trouble.
Because of those 2,000-pound bombs you dropped?
Yes. The wing commander was invited to the beach. A couple weeks later, he went down to the 4th and 5th floor down in that fort, and the imprint of some of the German soldiers were still on the wall. The whole profile of the man was still there.
Because the bomb had detonated and basically left that silhouette on the wall.
That's right.
Did you have a sense of how significant this was, what you guys were doing? I mean, because that day was such a turning point. So many lives were lost, but you were a part of something historic there.
We'd been on, by that time, it was my 21st mission. So I was a little battle-hardened to some of those things. We knew that the Navy and the ground forces were out there and all what they had to do, because the buildup had been so definitely in England. Just you're in it. It's your time.
And I don't want to oversimplify, and I don't want to embellish, but it sounds like what you're saying, when you went back to Normandy and you dropped those bombs, that the effect that those bombs had on the enemy was such that it saved a lot of American lives.
Oh, yes. We had been in England about 3 months by that time, and we had seen signs of bombing in London and elsewhere in England. So the effect of war was, we were fairly well warned what it would be like, because the English had survived from the Luftwaffe for so many years.
Yeah, you mentioned flak, and I'm sure you saw a lot of flak, and you had to fly through flak. What about fighters? Did your B-26s ever have to deal with German fighters?
My unit never did. I've seen them. I tried to shoot one down once, but he wouldn't come close enough. He was letting down after the invasion. He was east of Paris, over toward Lyon, and he had the gear and flaps down. Here he is with his gear and flaps down, coming out of a cloud just 600 feet from me, and I can't get that 50 caliber over there. I hollered at the gunner, the turret gunner on top, the top gunner, and he got the turret around and fired a couple rounds at him, but the fellow pulled his gear up and went back into the clouds. But can you imagine his story when he gets down to the officers' club that night? That he's been out chasing B-17s, and here he is, all ready to head in, done for the day. Puts the gear and flaps down, and he's coming down through the clouds with his 109. All of a sudden, he lands on top of a bunch of Marauders. I'd like to know where that German is today.
Wouldn't that be something if he were still around, if he survived the war in the 72 years since? George Eldridge sure has, going strong at age 100. When we come back, we'll hear about the mission for which he received the Purple Heart
Check out the photos of George at hometownheroesradio.com or the Hometown Heroes Facebook page. And we'll be right back after this.
Remember when the bank gave you free checking and savings accounts, even making money for you when you kept your dollars there? Paul Leffler here to say I've recaptured those days, and you can too with EECU. It's not a bank. It's a nonprofit credit union that just keeps growing and growing. The newest branch is in Tulare, and nearly a 250,000 EECU members represent 10 different California counties. As little as $250 in a savings account earns you dividends. And access is so easy. 30,000 ATMs, free mobile banking. And I haven't even told you what I love most about EECU, the credit union's support of causes up and down our area, like Central Valley Honor Flight. Nearly 1,000 veterans have gotten to see their memorials for free because of the leadership and financial support of EECU. Ready to join the team yet? Call 1-800-538-3328.